This is a Your Queer Story politisode with host Evan Jones, covering LGBTQ plus politics and policies in America and occasionally around the world. Join me now as we delve into what's happened in this last month in the world of queer politics. Hello, Queerstians. This is Evan Jones, one of the co-hosts of Your Queer Story, and you are here for one of our politisodes, which means you only get me and not Paul, but that's okay. I know you don't mind. Just don't tell Paul because he's sensitive. I'm joking. Anyways, I'm excited to be back. We didn't have a politisode in May, so I'm throwing one in here in June. I think it's very appropriate. Maybe the title caught your attention, The Fall of Pride, and what that means. That will be towards the end of the episode. If this is your first politisode, welcome. I hope you enjoy it. I really hope you enjoy politics, because that's a lot of what we talk about. Politics, queer theory, all these kinds of things that influence our queer culture that aren't specifically about queer pop culture. If you want to know more about queer pop culture, you should check out our segments Date Night with Sam and Evan. And if you still want to come back for that hard-hitting queer history and other things that are queer related, you can check out me and Paul's, or Paul and I's, standard Your Queer Story episodes. But I'm glad you're here today. Our first segment is news, LGBTQ news. I try to find a bizarre or weird story, but I don't have one today. Not to say I don't have one. I'm sure that there is something bizarre that's happened in the world of LGBTQ++. However, I could not pass up the chance to touch upon the incredible, devastating ruling that was handed down by the Supreme Court just last week, and that was the ruling around foster care. And Philadelphia, the city of Philadelphia, had refused to place foster children with the Catholic Social Service Agency because they refused to place children in homes with same-sex parents. And there is no policy in place that I know of that says that, you know, the Catholic Social Services refuses to affirm queer children, but I'm sure if you're placing children in strictly Catholic homes and they're working through an agency that is not affirming of LGBTQ plus communities, I'm sure we can understand where that's going. So a couple things about this decision. First of all, it was 9-0. So that means all Supreme Court justices sided with the Catholic Social Service Agency, saying that it was discrimination against their religious faith for the city of Philadelphia to refuse to place foster children in their care. I have obviously a lot of thoughts about this. I will say one thing that I have not looked into thoroughly, and I should, is whether or not the Catholic Social Services receives any kind of state funding. I am interested to know how that would work if you're receiving funds from a state and you're discriminating against same-sex parents, which is interesting because the city of Philadelphia is not allowed to discriminate against the Catholic Church, but the Catholic Church is allowed to discriminate against same-sex parents. So, and basically the Supreme Court decided that once again, queer people are deemed eligible for discrimination. And there's a lot of heartbreak around this. Of course, this doesn't mean that same-sex parents can't adopt in the city of Philadelphia or in the state of Pennsylvania. They can. If you're not familiar with the foster care system, typically what happens is you have a foster care, so you have what might be called DCYF, or child services in a state. They are the services that look out for the welfare of children, or at least that's what they're supposed to do, and they place those children in homes. And there are other agencies that will help with this endeavor because the foster care system is so completely overwhelmed with children. And again, a lot of reasons behind that. There is definitely a lot of abuse going on. It's also very disproportionate in the way that Black and brown families are targeted and have their children taken away for minor things that white families aren't even looked at. I mean, if you hear of horrendous abuses happening in some of these white or these wealthy white families especially, but these white middle-class families aren't even looked at. I grew up in a family where if I had been a part of a poor Black family, if my parents had been Latinx, I have no doubt we would have been removed from their home. But we were white middle-class people. And so the fact that we had bruises on our backs and our legs, you know, that's whatever. Anyways, me getting off into my childhood trauma, and you just joined us. Welcome to the first 5 minutes of your politisode. Anyways, my whole point is there's a lot of reasons why the foster care system is overrun. I'm not going to get into it, but I'm sure my wife and I will discuss it on our date night with Sam and Evan, which will be dropping in July, not this month. So there's reasons why a foster care system is overrun, but they brought in these other agencies to help support them. And it really does help. It helps as a foster parent myself. I can tell you having these extra agencies support you. So they help find placement for children. They stay connected with the foster parents. They provide a lot of activities and even kind of financial support or little things for the family to help them. So the Catholic Social Services is one of them. So I don't know though if they receive state funds. I just know that the Catholic Social Services is one of those side agencies that helps find placement for children. And the city of Philadelphia had said they weren't going to place children with them because of their discrimination. But that doesn't mean that same-sex parents cannot have children placed with them in Philadelphia. It just means they're not going to be placed through the Catholic Social Services, which means that any child that's going through the Catholic Social Services, they just have less of a chance of being in an affirming home, especially if they're LGBTQ+. And that's what is most disheartening and heartbreaking for me is the fact that you have kids who could be LGBTQ+, who could be queer, trans identifying, and they will be placed in a foster home that does not affirm them. And that is so devastating for a child. It makes my stomach turn to think about this. And what really makes my stomach turn is the fact that Philadelphia still has it completely legal for minors to be placed in conversion therapy. Now, a foster family technically cannot do that. They can't just place their child. There's a lot of regulations on who you can have as a therapist. And I don't know if the city of Philadelphia has to sign off on conversion therapy. But I know that a lot of these placements are for permanency, which means that you will gain more legal guardianship and then eventually adoption. And so I just want to imagine a trans child being adopted into or a gay child, it doesn't matter, a trans or gay child, a queer child being adopted by a Catholic family and then being placed into conversion therapy. Or imagine they're 7 or 8, they're adopted into this family, they grow up, and at 13, they're forced into conversion therapy to change who they are. This is one reason why. I mean, it's not just the discrimination against parents, it's the potential harm for queer children. And so it's a devastating ruling. It's going to have horrible effects, just as we've seen over and over again. Hopefully, at least the state of Pennsylvania outlaws conversion therapy for minors, which is somewhat of a protection. But a lot of these parents, even in states where it's outlawed, they just send their kid to some camp in Montana or Wisconsin or whatever. I shouldn't even say Wisconsin. I don't know if Wisconsin still has conversion therapy outlawed. I probably wouldn't be surprised if they have outlawed it. So let's say North Dakota. Anyways, but they get sent to one of these camps and they're out of the state. So technically their conversion therapy, it's okay. And so it just has some horrible effects. So keep that in mind. If you're in Philadelphia, if you're in Pennsylvania, my heart is with you. And I hope that we can see some turnaround on this, or we can see some movement in another direction in the next few years, at least some protections put in place for queer children. And if you're a same-sex foster parent, I really, my heart breaks for you. I hope you find a good agency and an affirming one that can help support you. But now we're going to move on to our next segment, which is spotlighting a queer leader. And our spotlight for this month goes to Geosectoma Neptune of the Passamaquoddy tribe. Neptune was recently awarded the United States Artist 2021 Fellowship Award. They also happen to be the first trans elected official in Maine. They are a two-spirit individual, and they've done a lot of good work. I just happened to stumble upon their announcement of their winning the fellowship. So this is a very esteemed award. It celebrates like artists and cultural practitioners and different individuals who have impacted the United States creative landscape. And they also, on the other hand, are doing a lot of political work. So they're actively educating and advocating for the Native and Indigenous people of our country. Some of their skill sets include being a basket maker, a drag queen, an activist, an educator, as well as many other things. And like I said, they're also a politician. And now U.S. Artist 2021 Fellowship Awardee. And they said about the award, For me, the message that my art carries is quite simple. We are still here. Indigenous people, Wabanaki people, Passamaquoddy people, Two-Spirit people, we are still here. Despite the many efforts to ensure that we would not be, we survived against insurmountable odds with our language, cultures, and stories intact, yet many people still do not even know that Indigenous people still exist. And so they're doing a lot to raise awareness about Indigenous people, about queer Indigenous people, about preserving their culture, and serving in their state, the state of Maine. So congratulations to Geo, Sectoma, Neptune. I hope you and wish you all the best, and I hope that you are able to accomplish the things that you want to accomplish, and thank you for inspiring the many queer and Two-Spirit people that will follow you. And now it's time for our main event, the reason that you came, or maybe not. Maybe you're just listening to this and your podcasts are playing on a loop in the background and you're not even hearing me. That's okay. I can be the sound that hums silently in your ears as you work on something else and pretend that you're totally focused. So here we are. We're talking about the Fall of Pride, and I chose that, first of all, because it was slightly less dramatic than my original title, which was The Demise of Pride. But the Fall of Pride is in reference to the fact that there are many Pride organizations across the United States right now that are facing harsh backlash, and some that are closing down, some that are rebranding. There's a lot going on. A few that come to mind, because I'm on the East Coast, I know that San Francisco Pride has faced some harsh backlash. I believe LA and Miami Pride. Again, I could be wrong. I'm not 100% certain on LA Pride. New York Pride has faced a lot of scrutiny over the years. But more recently, Philly Pride, or as it was called, the Philadelphia Pride Presents, was the main Pride organization in Philadelphia, recently shut down. Philly has had a rough week in the LGBTQ department. And so for all my Philly people out there, I love you. I love your city. I really do. If I ever had to live in a city, if you made me live in a city, it would absolutely be Philadelphia. I love it. I actually chose to spend my honeymoon there, and people are always shocked by that. It's a little weird because people are like, oh, we went to the Bahamas for our honeymoon, or they go to some resort somewhere, they take a cruise. And Samantha were like, no, you know what? We want to be in Philly. They got good food. They have great art. They have amazing history. And their queer scene is lit. That's where we want to be. So I love you, Philly, and I am sorry. But I know, you know, there's been just like here in Rhode Island, and don't worry, I'm going to get to Rhode Island Pride. But in Philadelphia Pride, there has been a lot of backlash in the last several years and pushback against the way the organization has been so white-centered, so gay and lesbian-centered, and just so party-centered. And so this, in the last, it seems like the organization has dissolved. They have taken down all their social media posts. They have closed their doors. And it is something that is happening to a lot of, especially smaller Pride organizations across the country. In the late last year, the same thing happened in Rhode Island Pride. So we had Rhode Island Pride, which had been around here for several decades, and they closed the door down, and it looked like that was the end of Rhode Island Pride, but surprise, bitches, they came back. And there's a whole sordid story there. And I don't have a problem talking about the story. It's just, it's a lot of details that that's not the purpose of my episode today. My purpose of my episode today is to talk about the queer revolution versus the gay rights movement and what that looks like and why it's different. And so I want to focus on that. But and it kind of explains a lot of what has happened in all these organizations. Boston Pride has been facing intense scrutiny. I will not be surprised if they topple soon. I hope they do, for a lot of the racism and misogyny that they've spread through the years. But in Rhode Island Pride, just to use as an example, I mean, we had a lot. There were years, there were decades of people coming forward and saying, hey, you've got some biases. There's a lot of racist policies. You know, your board is made up of mostly white gay men. And then, you know, there was a couple of other individuals included, but the board was set up as this, you know, you had an executive board, which really held the purse strings and therefore the power of the organization. And then you had a couple of what we like to call, you know, just figurine board members, which were people that they put out to make it look like they were very inclusive, but it turned out those board members didn't actually have any power. And so they came on board, and many of them in hopes of trying to change the board and change the direction of Rhode Island Pride. And they were shut down again and again, because the truth was Rhode Island Pride was about having a party, just like a lot of these other organizations have been about having a party and planning a really great Pride parade. And that's nice. It, you know, it really is. It's good for tourism and it's fun. And trust me, I have spent many, many sweat-filled nights in Pride parade parties, Pride parades and parties. I've wandered drunk into Pride parades. You've heard me in Paul talk about it. I've waved my rainbow flags and my trans flags outside of parades. I've been to the many block parties and after parties. I mean, I have benefited from prides just like every other queer person. And I don't have a problem with parades, and I don't have a problem with parties and celebrating queerness. I have a problem with organizations that benefit so heavily off the queer community, not reinvesting their money and their funds into that community, except for these parades. I have a problem with queer people sleeping homeless on the streets at outrageous amounts and not donating or giving any time or money to that, or constantly raising funds for community centers and endeavors and plans that never materialize. I have a problem with spending thousands and thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars on these huge events while there are queer people who can't even feed themselves. That's what I have a problem with. What I have a problem with is that Pride Parade became about showing to the rest of the world, look at how good the gays are doing, and just slapping a Band-Aid or just putting up a wall that hid out all the rest of the injustices that were happening within the queer community and without the queer community. I have a problem with the fact that every time you look at a Pride Parade poster, it's almost always going to have three or four white, ripped gay men standing there holding their margaritas as if they are the face of the queer community. And they have been made the face of the queer community. And because they've been made the face of the queer community, we've seen incredible harms done to smaller populations. We've seen incredible harms done to our disabled populations, to our BIPOC populations, to our trans populations within our communities. We've seen them excluded and shut out. We saw this during the AIDS epidemic. We saw this during the fight for gay marriage during, you know, throughout the late 90s and into the 2000s. And I'll get to that in a few moments. But there's a big difference, and it's highlighted in these parade parties. And what happens is these pride organizations, they attract all the funding. They are seen as the organization that represents the queer community. And so people pour hundreds and thousands of dollars into these organizations. And these organizations give us nothing back, nothing of substance anyway. They give us one to two parties a year, and that's it. And then, you know, maybe they organize some other social events. There really are the Madison Society of the early 1950s, which they're providing social events, but they're not providing any real social change. And so that's my problem. And that's the problem that a lot of people and a host of other, and like I said, these things, these organizations are often rife with sexism and misogyny and racism and ableism and transphobia and every other kind of ism that there is out there. Many of them have leadership that are known TERFs, which are trans exclusionary feminists. They shrug off and they look the other way at the injustices done against the trans community, or they clutch their thousands of dollars and their sometimes their hundreds of thousands, and in some of the bigger ones, even they got, you know, just outrageous amounts of money. They clutch their pearls to their chest and they say, I don't know how we can help these groups. Let's give them a float next year. And that's their answer to everything. And I'm going to get into it more, because what we're going to talk about is a topic that I've been saying I'm going to cover for years and that I've talked about sporadically through different episodes. And that's the queer revolution versus the gay rights movement. So if you've followed us in our history episodes, you have heard me talk about this, and you've probably picked up on a lot of these things. But The queer revolution is something that has always happened. It's an organic movement that has evolved ever since we've been in America. Now, you can technically count the indigenous people as the first queer resistors in America, but it's a little different, number one, because what white European Christians counted as queer was not queer to the natives. It was just their culture. And what they were defending was their culture and their right to existence. They weren't defending specifically their right to exist in a queer spectrum, although that was part of it. They were just being wiped out in general. And so, yes, the first queer individuals on America were the queer, were the natives and indigenous people and the First Nations. But when we're talking about the European colonialism and what spawned that, we would start that form of queer resistance somewhere around 1624 and the Marymount colony. And so that was one of the first colonies that really defied Puritan rule and therefore English monarchy and pushback. And then over the centuries, we saw various forms of queer resistance sprout up. We saw the female husbands of the late 1700s on through the 1800s and then to the early part of the 20th century. We saw, and those were individuals who were assigned female at birth, but they would live their life, or at least part of their life, as a man. And all of them were different. They weren't all transgender men. They weren't all non-binary people. Some of them would have identified as lesbians today. Others of them might not even identify as queer. They chose to live as a man because it gave them power and it gave them freedom. Although they might have to identify somewhat as queer, because if you were a female husband, that meant that you were a woman, or at least you were a person who was assigned female at birth who was married to a woman. So you did definitely have trans men, you had non-binary individuals, you had lesbians, and then you had other people that fell somewhere on the queer spectrum that took on these roles of the female husbands. You've got the Boston marriages and the Wellesley marriages, which were, again, two women that would live and build a life together. And, you know, they were just really good friends. You have all the bachelors like James Buchanan, who we covered in one of our episodes. You had the, you know, queer resistance combined with Black resistance, such as William Swan, the first drag queen. Asian immigration, Asian individuals brought over all of their cultural aspects with them, which a lot of people saw as effeminate or queer, and really was just part of a lot of Asian history. You had the Harlem Renaissance and all that, and that cultural renaissance that was very queer, the Latinx and Chicano movement. And so all throughout America's history, or the white America that we know, all throughout white American history, we have seen moments of queer resistance and queer revolution where people have fought back, either as an individual or as a group, in cities, in rural towns. All throughout America, we have seen this queer revolution, where people defy and stand up to these social norms around gender expression, identity, sex, and orientation. And then you have the gay rights movement. And the gay rights movement had its first formal spark in 1924 with the founding of the Human Rights Association in Chicago. That did not last very long, but that's the first time that we see a group of people formally organized with the intent of fighting for gay rights in America. And then, of course, we know by the mid-1950s, you have the Madison Society, the Daughters of Bilitis, the Janus Society, and these different chapters of these groups opening up across the country. You've got Frank Kameny and Tony Gonzura, and they're fighting back against the legal oppression that's put against people. And this is where we start to see a fight for legal recognition. And so if I were to define the two, I would say the queer revolution is defiance of social standards around gender expression, identity, sex, and orientation. And the gay rights movement is a fight for legal recognition and the erasure of bias policies against LGBTQ populations. And these two groups have often run parallel to each other's, and then at other times they've run opposite against each other. And right now we're in one of those opposite clashes, because the gay rights movement is notorious for wanting to quietly push things through, wanting to do the bare minimum, because this is what we know we can attain, and it's better to attain this little step than to get nothing at all. And the queer revolution is about a revolution. It's about changing. It's about upheaval. It's about breaking down these systems that have oppressed individuals. Some other differences between them is the queer revolution is very individually based and the gay rights movement is very movement based. And what that means is not to say that there aren't groups and pockets in the gay revolution or whatever we call that. It's to say that the gay rights movement is always about the movement first and what's going to benefit the movement over what might benefit the individual, which has caused a lot of exclusionary tactics and policies and even open resistance. Queer revolution is very much about a personal freedom. It's about the right to express yourself as you are regardless. So it doesn't say, here's how we're going to express ourselves the way that the gay rights movement was. And we saw this in the early beginnings of the gay rights movement with Frank Kameny, who would, when he was protesting, he made people wear a suit and tie. He made people, women had to wear dresses. They couldn't wear slacks or pants whenever they were protesting. Men had to wear suit and tie. Trans people weren't even allowed to protest. And so he would make people dress in a very assimilated way to show others that we weren't so-called a threat because a man in a dress or a trans individual or a non-binary person wearing an androgynous look, that's a threat to, these white heteronormative standards. And so this has a long history in our movement and it's created a lot, even more oppression, because what's happened is while the gay rights movement seeks for so-called justice for the movement as a whole, it creates these equal systems, but it doesn't create equitable systems, and it certainly doesn't bring justice for these populations as a whole. The queer revolution fosters an expansive and inclusive queer culture, while the gay rights movement assimilates to white heteronormative standards and culture, as I just touched upon. But to elaborate on more, what this means is, so the queer revolution, again, because they believe in the individual's personal freedom, the right to express yourself, you don't have to sit inside any label. You can have as many labels as you want. You can have no labels if you don't want them. That's what queer revolution is about. Gay rights movement says you need to have a label and you need to stay within the binaries of that label. And I don't care as much what that label is. You just need to stay in there. So if you are a transgender man with a feminine expression, that bothers me because I think that transgender men need to have a very binary masculine perception. If you are if you are very fluid, that bothers me because I think that, fluid causes problems. If your pronouns are fluid, that drives me nuts because you need to pick your pronouns and you need to stick with your pronouns. And so all of these things bother the gay rights movement because it's very binary, it's very structured, but most importantly, it very much assimilates to the white heteronormative standards. And that is exactly, again, what literally leaders would say in the beginning parts of the gay rights movement through the 50s, 60s, 70s, and through the 80s, and you will still find people talking about it today. We need to be acceptable. We need to be desirable to the outside community. We need to show that we're not a threat. We need to show that we can be just like them. And that's why we see things like Boston Pride, where it's a bunch of people. There's nothing wrong with the conservative. There's nothing wrong with a queer person being conservative. There is something wrong with saying that is what we should attain. That's what we should want to attain. And Boston Pride over the years has become more and more conservative, wanting to shy away from the flamboyance and the loudness of our communities because it doesn't paint the picture. And the picture that they want is two dads and a kid who go to church on Sundays, and they're just like you. They're just like their white middle-class neighbors across the street. But the truth is, queer culture, again, the queer revolution defies that. It pushes back. It doesn't mean that you can't be two dads with a kid who goes to church. It just means that's not the right way, and it's not the better way. It's a way. It's also a way to be in a polyamorous relationship, that where, one person is trans and one person is gender non-defying and you're all atheists. And then there's that one who's a witch. And that's also queer. It's also the queer revolution to have an open marriage or to eschew marriage altogether. It's also the queer revolution to be fluid between your gender or to be agender. That's also part of the queer revolution. And so to say that this heteronormative family style is the way is wrong. The same way, it's also wrong to say that completely defying that is wrong, to say that you can't be a heteronormative Christian family But the gay rights movement has always, because of this desire to assimilate and because of this desire to appease white culture and white middle class and wealthy culture, the gay rights movement has always centered white middle class gays. So white middle class gays and lesbians, while the queer revolution has always been led by poor BIPOC populations. It always has. It's always been the poor people. It's always been Black, Brown, Indigenous, Asian, and other minority communities that have fought back because they have had little to lose. The gay rights movement, though unintentionally sometimes, has always upheld white supremacy standards. So the white supremacist standards. So gay rights buys into these standards that this is what's right. Again, this nuclear family, but it's just with a slight twist, upholding the systems that are in place, upholding the, celebrating the police. This is why they want, you know, police to march in pride, because they believe that that shows that we're in solidarity with a system that we know is incredibly racist, that was built on racism, and that continues to perpetuate these racist and these murderous tendencies and policies, that has disproportionately continued to fill the prisons with Black and Latinx and other minority populations and trans populations. So they celebrate, so the gay rights movement celebrates these white supremacist institutions and pushes people to continue to assimilate and reach for the validation from these groups, while the queer revolution pushes back against that. And part of the reasons why this is so bad is these systems that benefit white middle class and wealthy individuals, even when we do get them on our side, they only reaffirm their benefits for the white middle class and wealthy. It just makes a slight adaptation to include white gays and lesbians. So again, with the thing around same-sex marriage, I'm glad that people have the right to marry. I really am. I mean, I am married as a queer individual. I am married, and I would not have been allowed to marry 10 years ago. Technically, I wouldn't have been allowed to marry 6 years ago, but I appreciate the right to marry. But when we were fighting for the right to marry and we talked about marriage equality, we never talked about marriage equality for disabled people. And we never talked about making sure there were policies in place so that trans people could be married in their affirmed gender. There were so many parts about marriage equality that we didn't fight for. We just made sure that gays and lesbians had the right to marry. And that's what the gay rights movement has done over and over again, right? They fight to repeal the sodomy laws, but they don't fight to repeal some of the other laws that harm, that disproportionately harm queer individuals. Where is the outrage and the open stance against police brutality? Where is the outrage and the open stance against some of the harms and some of the laws that have been arbitrarily used against Black, Brown, Indigenous populations? When we work to reaffirm these white supremacist systems, we don't make them as inclusive as they want. These systems are already used against BIPOC and disabled and trans and intersex communities. When we support these systems, or when we look for legal validation from these systems, we're only seeking that validation, again, for those who the systems already benefit. And the systems already benefit white, middle class, and wealthy Americans. So when we seek for approval from these systems, we only benefit wealthy and middle class gays and lesbians. So again, queer revolution pushes back against this. The queer revolution says these systems need to be dismantled. They don't work for us. We don't want to assimilate to them. We don't want their validation. We don't want their approval. They are in the wrong. They are broken. And the gay rights movement says, how about we just amend things a little bit so that we can slip inside? And that's where we see a lot of the rift in the movement, as where we see now. That's why we see a lot of people calling for the end of Pride, so to speak. Queer revolution feeds the social conversation, and the gay rights movement does build off of that. So it's the queer revolution that starts these conversations around gender identity and gender expression and queer rights. They are the ones that start and feed the commentary on these issues. And the gay rights movement takes that and says, okay, how can we make this law? But often they do that at the exclusion of big portions of their community. So again, going back and just reaffirming this point again and again, we see the gay rights movement goes for the benefit of a few, and they intentionally exclude people that they feel are not going to get those laws passed. So again, when you're looking to pass laws on marriage equality, it's not about making sure that all people have the right to marry. It's about making sure that this small group has the right to marry. And they say, well, we're going to do that because we're going to build upon that. And they will build upon the laws. It's just going to take another 50, 60, maybe 100 years before you're going to get equality. And that's okay. They're willing to live with that because at least for a time, you know, this one group of people is able to benefit from the law. And they call that progress. And sure, I guess you could call it progress, but is it really progress that we've only made a slight amendment we've made all these slight amendments that only benefit one group of our entire wide and diverse community? And we have all the rest of the community that's still hurting. We have all the rest of the community that still needs equity, that still needs to see justice, and we haven't seen that yet. And most importantly, the queer revolution is not and will not be funded. It will never be funded because it's considered too radical. Whereas the gay rights movement, because of its assimilation, because of its exclusion of the undesirables, because of the fact that it constantly turns its back or shrugs its shoulders and says that it can't do anything about police brutality, that it can't do anything about the prison industrial system, that it can't do anything about injustice against Black Americans and Asian Americans and Latinx Americans and indigenous people, because it constantly turns its back on those things, the gay rights movement has become incredibly funded, has become well-funded, and has created strong connections, and even has whole branches of it that are completely conservative and openly fight against the rights of other queer people. It has come to this full circle movement where the gay rights movement that was once fighting the system has become the system and uses that system to continue to oppress their queer siblings. So that is the difference between the gay rights movement and the queer revolution. And the queer revolution will continue on. It will continue to evolve. It will continue to move forward, and it will continue to fight back against these systems. The problem is that the gay rights movement is the one with the funding and the one with the leadership at the top and the one that guides the conversation and the one that wears the mask of so-called representing the LGBTQ+ community. And whenever the other parts of the queer community say, hey, we don't want you representing us anymore, the top leadership, that top white gay and lesbian leadership, turns around and says, how dare you? How dare you be so ungrateful? How dare you defy me when I've done so much for the community? But you haven't done so much for the community. You've done so much for your portion of the community. You've done so much for your people, and you forgot that our community is so much broader than your narrow scope. And what we're seeing in these pride organizations is we're seeing these wealthy white gays who have led the movement for 10, 20, 30 years suddenly being challenged, being called out for their racism, being called out for their sexism, being called out for their transphobia, being called out for their exclusion. And they can't handle it. They can't handle it. And so, as in the case of Rhode Island Pride, they put their tail between their legs. They shut their organization down, and they got online and they cried about how cancel culture and keyboard warriors shut down their organization. And they never stopped and said, hey, maybe I created an organization that only benefited a few. Maybe it's time for me to step aside so a new generation can step in and continue to move forward on the policies that need to be enacted. Yes, it's true that 60 years ago, we didn't even have the right to hold hands and kiss in public. And I appreciate the people who paved the way for that. But we're continuing to move forward. That wasn't the end. That wasn't the line that we crossed. And now we have nothing else that we need to worry about. There's so much more that we need to move forward. And if you're not moving forward, get the fuck out of the way. And that's what we saw in Philadelphia Pride, and that's what we're seeing in other Pride. I encourage you, first of all, to be aware of what's happening with your Pride agency. And if you're saying, I'm so fed up and tired with them, okay, but organize against them. Shut them down. Get that money and divert it to something that needs to happen. If you live in Rhode Island, there's the House of Kodak, which is raising money to create a youth transitional shelter. It is not just for LGBTQ people, but we know that there's a big disproportionate presence of LGBTQ youth on the streets. It is led by queer individuals. So donate your money to the House of Kodak. RI Pride is saying that they're making a comeback and they're going to throw us another party in September. And I'll be honest, I do not want your fucking pride. I'm okay with the parties as long as we're addressing the other issues. But if you're not addressing the other issues, take that money and please give it to someone who's going to do something for our people. Our people are starving. They are on the streets. They are in prisons. They are being beaten by people on both sides of the law. What are we doing about it? You take your party and your beer and your lights and your rainbows, and you can shove it if you're not actually helping the community. So get involved, please. And on that note, thank you for hanging in there with me, folks. It was longer than I expected, but I say that after every Politisode. I hope that you have had a good Pride Month considering everything else. I hope that you had a chance to show your pride, whether online or maybe if you were able to go out in a group or whatever is going on in your town or city. And I hope that you do get involved. Again, check out the House of Codec, HAUS of CODEC, House of Codec. You can find them on Facebook and online. Donate your money to a good cause if you live in Rhode Island. If you don't live in Rhode Island, if you live in Philadelphia, find a good organization that you can put your money to. And if you can't find a queer organization, donate, you know, find a good Black or Latinx or Asian or Indigenous run organization and donate your money there. Make sure it goes to a good cause. And I will be back with you all soon. Stay queer.